It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Wisconsin voter turnout in last week's presidential election was the lowest it's been statewide in two decades. We'll focus in on what happened in Milwaukee and then on what happened statewide with two guests coming up.
First, on 60 Minutes last night, President-elect Donald Trump talked about his immigration plans. In the interview, he said he plans to immediately deport 2 to 3 million undocumented immigrants. He said he would emphasize deporting criminals before deciding about law-abiding families who are in the country illegally.
What we are going to do is get the people that are criminal and have criminal records, gang members, drug dealers. We have a lot of these people, probably 2 million, it could even be 3 million. We're getting them out of our country or we're going to incarcerate. But we're getting them out of our country. They're here illegally. After the border is secured and after everything gets normalized, we're going to make a determination on the people that you're talking about who are terrific people. They're terrific people. But we're going to make a determination at that. But before we make that determination, Leslie, it's very important. We want to secure our border.
During an interview with Jake Tapper on CNN's State of the Union that also aired yesterday, House Speaker Paul Ryan agreed that border security was a top priority for Congress, but he said there would not be mass deportations.
Congress writes the laws and controls the purse strings. Is there going to be mass deportation or not? And this isn't just a nitty-gritty detail. There are, you know, millions of people who are very worried about this.
Sure. Sure. And I think we should put people's minds at ease. That is not what our focus is. That is not what we're focused on. We're focused on securing the border. We think that's first and foremost, before we get into any other immigration issue, we got to know who's coming and going in the country. We've got to secure the border. So we believe an enforcement bill, a border security enforcement bill, is really the first priority, and that's what we're focused on.
Okay, so it's not a top priority, mass deportation, but obviously President-elect Trump thinks it
no,
is.
No, securing the border is our
right.
Securing the border is our top priority.
Right, but what about in year two, year three, year four?
That's why I say we're not focused on. We are not planning on erecting a deportation force. Donald Trump's not planning on that.
Alan Gomez joins us now to talk about how immigration policy might play out in Donald Trump's presidency. He's an immigration reporter at USA Today. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, can you compare and contrast some of what we heard from Donald Trump on the campaign trail, where it seemed like he was talking about deporting all undocumented immigrants, numbers in the 10 million or so zone, I think, now down to this 2 or 3 million immigrants, undocumented immigrants, who he says have criminal records?
Yeah, if we think back to the very beginning of his campaign, and it seems so long ago when he came down that escalator and started this whole thing off, in that very first speech, he talked about the need to deport people who were here illegally. It's about 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the country right now. In the ensuing weeks, reporters had asked him, how many does that mean? And he said all of them. He kept repeating that it was all 11 million, that we need to go in that direction. He kept up that tone throughout the campaign. Throughout his rallies, throughout his speeches, he kept railing against illegal immigration, saying they have to go. But over the last few months, he started kind of throwing in this little caveat that, you know, once we secure the border, once we get the bad guys out, as he said recently during one of the last speeches when he referred to them as bad hombres, after getting all of them out, then maybe we could talk about what to do with those that are left behind. And so this him on Sunday saying for the first time that he's targeting about 2 to 3 million, yeah, that's a very sharp departure from get all of them out as he started this whole thing out. And I think it kind of gets to a little bit more of a realistic expectation of what a president could accomplish, even with, you know, as much as they want to throw at this problem.
Now let's talk about that number, the idea of 2 or 3 million. He's talking about people who are criminals with criminal records, gang members, drug dealers. That's from that clip we played there. I don't know if we have solid numbers. Does that seem like a plausible number that would fit that category?
I think when we talk about 2 to 3 million, we're talking about undocumented immigrants that have any kind of criminal record. Every study I've ever seen, and I've been covering immigration for a long time, puts the number of people with gang ties, with criminal serious criminal felonies on their records. That's I've seen those numbers down to about a million. I mean, that's probably more what we're talking about. So to get to a number like 2 to 3 million, I mean, we're bringing in DUIs, we're bringing in minor felonies, we're bringing in misdemeanors, and so basically anybody who's had any kind of exposure to the criminal justice system in this country. And so, yeah, that 2 to 3 number, that's definitely the high range of this population that has any kind of criminal record.
Can we talk about deportation under President Obama? As I understand it, there have been, 2 or 2.5 million deportations under President Obama. His executive orders wanted to focus on people with criminal backgrounds. Is Donald Trump saying things that sound similar to what President Obama had already been doing?
Yeah, definitely the scope is much different, but the strategy sounds to sort of kind of be starting to fall in line a little bit with what President Obama has done. So understand, over President Obama's tenure, he upset many immigrant advocacy groups. He insulted a lot of Hispanic groups. At one point, the leader of the National Council of La Raza called him the deporter-in-chief because of how many people he was deporting from this country. There was a period in the middle of his administration where he was averaging about 400,000 deportations a year, and in each of those cases, he was setting a national record. But at the same time, the number of what they've been doing is increasing the percentage of undocumented immigrants who were deported who had a criminal record, and that was their focus, going after those kind of folks. As he said it, I think at one point, going after gang bangers, not grandmas. And so we saw that increase. We saw them going after more criminal aliens, and overall, the number of deportations started to fall because they were focused on that population. There's just not that many of them once you really target them. So yeah, he's absolutely been trying to push this idea of trying to go after these criminal immigrants. And yeah, it sounds like a President Trump would follow that and very obviously ramp that up as much as he can.
Talking to Alan Gomez from USA Today about immigration policy in a Trump administration, what might or might not change. Let's talk about this idea of a deportation force. This is what Donald Trump had mentioned on the campaign trail. He seems to be dialing back on that. Some Paul Ryan said specifically there, we're not planning on erecting a deportation force. So what about how we enforce these laws, Alan?
Well, that's been, I think what we're seeing with President-elect Trump is what happens to most presidents when they're done with a campaign and are about to step into the White House, where, sort of the bluster of the campaign has to meet the reality of governing. And as he gets in there, we already have a pretty large deportation force. There are more than 5,000 Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents that are right now working around the country. There are over 20,000 Border Patrol agents, mostly along the southwest border. And so all a President Trump would have to do is sort of refocus and retask all of those folks to really go after every undocumented immigrant they can find. For example, a lot of ICE agents right now, they're tasked with reviewing files at businesses, at job sites, to make sure that they're hiring legal workers, punishing employers who are hiring undocumented immigrants, doing different things within the world of immigration. But what a President Trump could immediately do without any congressional assistance is absolutely focus everybody to go after undocumented immigrants and to ramp up the number of deportations. In order to increase the number of ICE agents, they would need congressional approval, they'd need more funding, but very quickly he can sort of turn that mechanism around and make everybody really go after and try to ramp up deportations as quickly as possible.
Let's talk about the wall, Alan. Donald Trump on the campaign trail, very specific, we're going to build a big wall, he's talking about, and now this weekend he said a fence would work in some places. And now, as I understand it, we have a combination of walls, fences, electronic surveillance, things like that. When it comes to infrastructure at the border, what do we have now? What does it sound like we might be moving toward with Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think anybody who spent any amount of time along the border understands that the idea of a 50-foot wall along the entire 2,000 miles of border was never going to happen, partly because of the terrain. There's giant mountains, there's huge valleys, there's rivers, there's farms, partly because a lot of the land on the U.S. side is privately owned, so that would take a long time to sort of resolve, and partly because there are just parts where it just doesn't make any sense. There's whole stretches of desert in Arizona and New Mexico where there's not a lot of immigration because it's just would probably be impossible to kind of make it across during that point. So what he's looking at now, what he's talking about now, is, again, more of that sort of realistic view of what's possible down there. Right now we have a total of about 650 miles of any kind of barriers. So that's a combination of walls, fences, road barriers, different things like that. I mean, some of it is just incredibly easy to, you know, I've walked along parts of it where I'm like, okay, I can just hop over this little fence here. It's not that big of a deal. But those are built in areas where maybe there's a lot of vehicle traffic, so they were trying to reduce that. But yeah, once you start going mile by mile and start assessing what's necessary, what's not, in population centers, it makes sense to have a wall or a double wall with people patrolling in between in some of these vast stretches of the border where there's not that much of a population, where it's not that easy for people to cross and quickly assimilate into the U.S. population. Maybe you don't need that much stuff. So it sounds like, you know, he's kind of hearing from a lot of folks along the border and getting a little bit more of a realistic understanding of what's necessary and what's possible down there.
We're talking to reporter Alan Gomez from USA Today about how immigration policy might change under President-elect Donald Trump.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see immigration policy change in the United States? What do you think about this idea of perhaps mass deportations? Do you think we should change the pathway to citizenship in the United States? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a minute here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about immigration now with Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about President-elect Donald Trump's immigration plans? What do you want to see change? What are you worried about changing under a Trump presidency? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Tina on the line in Lake Geneva. Tina, hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm a substitute teacher. I'm an educator here in the area where we have probably in our middle school and grade school 75% Hispanic in the outlying city that I teach in. And I recently did a three-week assignment for sheltered English. And the students there were terrified of what is going to happen to their families. And I think right now, just as a human being, my heart breaks for them. I just want to know what policymakers, when you're actually looking into the faces of these children, what is the answer? And I don't understand, you know, I've just heard this rhetoric from people, well, their parents are criminals because they're here illegally, and as long as their parents are here legally, they have nothing to fear. They're children.
Alan, Tina, thanks a lot for that call. Alan, what are we hearing from immigrants themselves, from immigrant advocacy organizations as we head toward Donald Trump's inauguration?
Absolute terror. I mean, and it's across the board. I mean, he can talk all he wants about, hey, we're just going to target people with extensive criminal records. But, you know, as we said at the top of the show, in order to get to 2 to 3 million people, you're not talking just about murderers and folks that rise to that level. You're roping in a lot of people who have just very minor transgressions that aren't violent, and so that's a huge pool of people that are impacted. And then, you know, you add the idea that one of the things that President Trump has vowed to do is to eliminate a program called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or it's called known as DACA, which President Obama created and has so far protected more than 800,000 young undocumented immigrants from deportation. You know, one of their fears in originally signing up for this program is that they were basically going to be turning in all of their personal information, all their addresses, all of that kind of stuff over to the federal government. And, hey, what happens if a different administration comes in and has access to all those records? And now they're seeing that happen. I would think that there would be the lowest priority of people to be deported because they're young, they're generally working and going to school, and they have been to some degree vetted by the federal government already. But I can tell you so many of them are paranoid right now because they think, hey, they have our address on record. We might be the first ones to go. So now it's just really swept across the entire community, and people are just freaking out all over this country right now.
Tina, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Alan, I think what a lot of people are trying to figure out, and you can't read minds, I know, but which is the real Donald Trump on immigration? Is it what he said on the campaign trail? Is it what he's saying now in the run-up to becoming president? Are people guessing one way or the other?
And that, I think guessing is the appropriate word there, because it's, you know, and I think this extends beyond immigration. There's just so many things, you know, any campaign that we have, right? There's always that idea of what they're saying on the stump and what they're saying during debates. You know, Republicans go further right, Democrats go further left during their primaries, and they kind of come back a little bit. And then once they get into office, it's always, you know, let's see what of all of that will you implement. With Trump, it's just that times a thousand because of the hyperbole that he uses, because of the way that he's talked about so many things in such absolute and talked about things in terms that we've never really had to grapple with. Like, for example, with the refugee program, he's talked about eliminating it entirely. And to be quite honest, as an immigration reporter, this is the first time I had to research that. And I realized that, yes, a president has the exclusive power to absolutely shut down the refugee program and restrict any refugees from entering the United States. He doesn't need congressional approval. He can do that on his own. So that's just one example of all these, sort of him taking things to such an extreme that we've never seen before, which is why it's so hard to gauge what he's going to do now once he gets into office.
We're talking to Alan Gomez from the USA Today, looking at immigration policy as we approach a Donald Trump presidency. Back to our callers now with Pat on the line in Madison. Pat, hi.
Hi, thank you. My question was this. During the campaign, Trump said that he's going to stop all funding to sanctuary cities. And that my question is this. Is what kind of funding are we talking here? All federal funding? And if he does that, does that have to go through like a budgetary process, through congressional hearings, as far as saying, our budget now is this, and we're not going to give any money to this city because they're harboring illegals? And does he have the authority now to just go into those cities and grab illegals that are being protected by these sanctuary cities and say, here, sorry, you're protecting them, but they're now going bye-bye?
Pat, thanks for the call. Alan, let's start with what a sanctuary city is. As I understand it, that just means police departments don't automatically report undocumented people for every police interaction to immigration authorities. Is that right?
Exactly. And just to extend it just a little bit, any government worker in that city would be almost forbidden from turning over an undocumented immigrant that they encounter over their day-to-day work over to federal immigration officials. So, yeah, the next step is, you know, Trump has vowed to cut off funding for these cities. This is one area where, we're all working in a little bit of gray right here, so bear with me. But that's the kind of thing that I think he would have to work a lot with Congress on, because basically what you're saying is, you know, the highway money that goes to states, federal education dollars that go to states, health care money that goes to cities and counties and local governments. I mean, there's just so many different channels of money that go into these into these local governments. And so that would require, from what we understand, to go into all of those different sort of appropriation bills in Congress, you know, tweak them to adjust it so that they will withhold it for certain governments, local governments that withhold this money. There is talk of possibly passing a sort of sweeping bill that through Congress that says if you declare yourself a sanctuary city or kind of implement those kind of policies, that we're just going to cut you off completely. I think a lot of people question whether that's possible because, again, of all these different revenue streams that you'd have to get into. But looking at the makeup of this Republican Congress right now, it looks like he could get a lot of help from them, and it looks like something like that could get passed. So it's absolutely a very real possibility.
Pat, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Isaac on the line in Ontario. Isaac, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Oh, I think the wall is a very good idea. You know, I've heard a lot, studied a little bit on the border about how, they'll deport somebody that's here illegally that commits a crime or something, and then they'll just come right on back, So that, I think, is a very good idea. It needs to start with that. And if they're here illegally, you know, they're breaking the law, they probably should go back, you know. And as far as the process to do it, I don't think that somebody that's here, you know, that's not, like, you know, a dangerous person, they shouldn't be deported. You know, they have families and stuff. I don't agree with that. But I do think that, you know, somebody that does commit crime should, you know, be deported. And, you know, they shouldn't be here on worker like me's tax dollars. You know what I mean? They, you know, get Medicaid or, you know, and they all need health care. I agree with that. But, you know, if they're here illegally, you know, we're paying for these people that came here without doing the proper process. And also, why don't we make the process faster? I mean, I know...
Isaac, I want to jump in because we just have a couple minutes. You brought up a lot of interesting points. Alan, first of all, the idea of there's a tax burden undocumented immigrants on the rest of us.
Oh, man, we could do a whole show on that question, but to give you the quick response, there was an interesting study that came out recently, and this was from the National Academy of Sciences, and they spent years researching this. There has been untold numbers of economic reports from groups on both sides of the debate that they took all those reports, they took all this data, and they crunched it, and their conclusion, I think, is something that sounded about right, where basically that first wave, when they're undocumented immigrants and they first get here, you know, in their first few years, they're using the hospitals, their kids are using schools, and so they end up being a net negative economically. But once their kids start growing up, and once they reach that second generation and third generation, then they become a massive economic benefit, because not only because of the work that they're doing, but then the kids are going to school, they're going to university, and you know, it's a long story, but I think the idea of what immigrant labor does in this country and has historically done is the fact that so many other countries, their economies are contracting because they don't have enough immigration, while that has helped continue the United States' economic well-being.
We'll leave it there. A lot more, I'm sure, we'll get into in the months to come. Alan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
We've been talking to Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today. He joined us to talk about how immigration policy could change under President-elect Donald Trump.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to Milwaukee's chief election official about low voter turnout in last week's presidential election. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll take a look at why Wisconsin had the lowest presidential election voter turnout in 20 years.
First, we're looking at election turnout in Wisconsin's biggest city, Milwaukee. The city saw a decline of about 41,000 voters last week when compared to the 2012 presidential election between President Barack Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney. In that election, President Obama won Milwaukee and coasted re-election.
Neil Albrecht joins us now to talk about what happened in Milwaukee. He's the executive director of Milwaukee's Election Commission. Neil, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Veronica. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, Neil, what did you see on Election Day last week in Milwaukee?
Well, we saw, as you identified, a really significant decline in voter participation in the city of Milwaukee. 41,000 voters of a city of roughly 600,000, and that represented a 12% decrease in voter participation. When we saw those numbers, we were very concerned about whether those numbers basically could be applied across the board to all districts in the city of Milwaukee, or whether there was some disproportionate representation of decreases in voter participation. And so we immediately did some analysis of the data from the election and identified that the aldermanic districts in the city that have the highest concentration of communities in poverty saw by far the greatest decreases in rates of voter participation, some as high as 32% drop from the 2012 presidential election. And that was very concerning to us because when the Wisconsin legislature and the governor were looking at enacting the photo ID requirement, we expressed grave concern that changes to Wisconsin's election law were going to disproportionately affect people in poverty.
So when you look at the participation in the primary, what did you see there? Did you also see a depressed turnout?
Well, what we saw was, you know, a statewide, very high rate of voter participation in the April presidential primary, you know, driven by the particular voter interest in that presidential primary. But what we also saw, because that was the first really significant election where Wisconsin's photo ID law was in effect, so what we also saw was a growing gap between voter participation in the city of Milwaukee compared to the state average. So that was really our first indicator that the photo ID requirement was having an adverse reaction on communities in poverty in the city of Milwaukee, and that while turnout for that election was certainly robust, we were not seeing those same rates of participation in those particular communities.
And there were observers at some polling places. What do you know about what may have happened to those voters who came to the polls and maybe didn't have a proper ID? I mean, is there evidence that the election law did affect the turnout?
Well, Veronica, I would say that in the city of Milwaukee, we issued 120 provisional ballots. And that number truly represents only the tip of the iceberg in terms of how photo ID affected voters. Because what we hear from our chief inspectors, the site supervisors at the city's polling place, is that most voters are not interested in voting a provisional ballot. If you have a familiarity with the concept of provisional voting, your ballot isn't counted until after the election, and voters are interested in casting a ballot at the same time as every other voter in an election. They don't want it counted after the election has concluded. So most people who were not able to meet the photo ID requirement left without voting. But Wisconsin has also had a failed public education campaign, particularly with regard to educating the difficult communities to reach, like people in poverty, around the photo ID requirement. So there's a lot of confusing information out there, and I also think a lot of people may have felt simply that they would not be able to meet these new requirements and so did not go to their polling places on election day.
Well, let's talk about that voter ID law education campaign. There were some efforts early on with the voter ID law, and then we had a federal judge ordering a renewed push after there was a lawsuit and some confusion at the DMV. Do you think that those efforts were effective? And if not, what do you think failed?
Well, the judge, Judge Peterson, intervened because the federal courts recognized that the efforts to reach people in poverty who are going to be the most challenged by meeting the documentation requirements to secure a photo ID, even a free photo ID, were not receiving accurate information from the DMV. They were being turned away from the DMV, or they weren't receiving messaging at all about the photo ID requirement. And granted, the judge did make additional requirements in terms of public education, but those happened in the weeks before the election. And with such a short amount of time and such a difficult-to-reach population, I don't feel any level of confidence that members of that community necessarily received accurate information or any information about the photo ID requirement and some options that may have been available to them.
We're talking with Neil Albrecht right now, Executive Director of Milwaukee's Election Commission. He's talking about why there may have been low voter turnout last week in Milwaukee during the presidential election. And some election pundits, they point to the fact that Milwaukee didn't expand in-person absentee voting as much as Madison did, that Milwaukee opened fewer locations despite having a bigger population than Madison. So why wasn't there a larger effort to open more early voting sites if this was a concern about voter ID law and some possible confusion?
Well, sure, Amanda. I guess I'd respond to that by saying in the city of Milwaukee, our previous record for early voting or in-person absentee voting was the 2012 presidential election, where we had 36,500 people cast in-person absentee ballots for that election. That number jumped 37% to 52,300 early voters in this election, and we expanded our hours of operation from the 110 that had previously been allowed by law to 725 hours. So we had a significant expansion in the number of location in the hours that early voting was made available for the 6 weeks leading up to the election. And our success was really demonstrated by the huge increase in early voting ballots that we saw in the city of Milwaukee.
So if you had to do it over today, you wouldn't add any more early voting locations?
Well, here's what I would do over differently, if you will, is I would not have put the restrictions on early voting in the first place that put all of us in the position of having to really establish the types of early voting that should have been available and should have been planned for all along in the 10 weeks preceding a presidential election. So I look forward to the opportunity to expand our early voting further for future elections, but I think given the timeline that we had and given our awareness that this was going to be very closely scrutinized and that everything needed to be done correctly, I feel very positively just about the increased voter access that our expanded schedule did provide.
And as we wrap up, I want to ask you, as the numbers have it today, Donald Trump got over 27,000 more votes than Hillary Clinton. And Milwaukee, which is historically a deep blue city area of the map, saw lower voter turnout by 41,000 votes, 60,000 in Milwaukee County. So did that lower voter turnout in Milwaukee give Wisconsin to Donald Trump? And did it lose the state for Hillary Clinton?
Well, I can't really answer that question, Veronica. It would not be appropriate for me to speculate. And I would say certainly that whether or not voters feel strongly toward candidates in an election impacts voter participation. But I also hear this notion that I hear that used as an explanation for why turnout in itself was down in the city of Milwaukee. And I don't think that does any sort of justice to, an explanation or examining why voter turnout actually decreased. I look just to the city of Chicago with very similar demographics, certainly a larger city, but similar demographics to the city of Milwaukee, and they actually saw increased voter participation in the city of Chicago. The difference between Milwaukee and Chicago being Chicago has no photo ID requirement.
Neil, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Neil Albrecht, Executive Director of Milwaukee's Election Commission, and he joined us there to talk about why there may have been low voter turnout last week in Milwaukee during the presidential election.
Coming up, we'll take a step back and look at voter turnout statewide. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we look at how the average American's finances could look with Donald Trump in the White House.
Right now, we continue our conversation about voter turnout in last week's presidential election. We just heard about Milwaukee. Now we turn to statewide totals. In Tuesday's election, voter turnout was at a two-decade low.
Wisconsin had the highest presidential primary turnout since 1972 and the second highest presidential election turnout in the nation in 2008 and 2012.
But in the general election last week, the state saw its lowest presidential election voter turnout in 20 years.
Jessie Opoyan joins us now to talk about these numbers. She's a political reporter for the Capital Times. Jessie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's look at how much lower general election turnout was this year than in past presidential elections. What are the numbers?
Yeah, so it came in about 2.9 million votes. It was about 66% of the voting age population. Elections officials in the state had projected it to be about 69%. So it's lower than what they were expecting. It's lower than what we've seen over the last several years, really for quite a while. We've seen the trend going up in terms of turnout. And in 2012, it was 70%. In 2008, it was 69%. 2004, it was 73%. But the last time it was this low was way back in 1996 at 58%.
And how did the numbers compare with the primary numbers?
That's a good question. I don't have the primary numbers in front of me, actually. But
primary numbers are supposed to be pretty big, though, right?
Yeah, it was big, but it was still it was a higher number for the general than it was for the primary. So while the primary election was a record-setting one in terms of turnout, it didn't eclipse the general this year.
And you spoke to a couple of Republican strategists. What did they say about voter turnout and why we saw that dip in turnout this season?
Yeah, the Republican strategist that I talked to, obviously coming at it with a particular point of view, the biggest thing they pointed to was an enthusiasm gap, and there were a couple of Democrats who said the same thing. The truth is that Hillary Clinton is a very different candidate from Barack Obama, and energized voters in a very different way, and arguably just not as much as he did. Looking at counties that traditionally vote for Democrats, Dane County sort of held up its end of the bargain. Milwaukee County, as you've been talking about with your last guest, didn't really turn out, and the rest of the state looked at the candidates and where a lot of counties had gone for Barack Obama in the past, they went for Donald Trump this year.
So we mentioned Milwaukee County is a place that saw decreased voter turnout. Are there other places in the state like that?
Really, most counties in the state actually did see lower turnout. That was consistent across the state. It was just a little more dramatic and a little bit more noticeable somewhere like Milwaukee County, where really both parties, but especially Democrats, are used to seeing a large number of votes.
So you mentioned what the Republican strategist that you talked to, what they called an enthusiasm gap, meaning that it seems like voters just weren't that into maybe these candidates, and in particular Hillary Clinton, it looks like, in Democratic areas. And is that what's being said here, that these were not candidates that had people fired up to go and vote for them?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of intra-party fighting about that on the Democratic side at this point over whether that was the case. But among Republicans, I think it's pretty clear that Donald Trump was able to tap into something, especially in rural counties, in the areas of the state that just aren't as defined by politics as a place like Dane or Milwaukee or the WOW counties around surrounding Milwaukee. He was able to tap into what a lot of people are describing as this attitude of resentment, whether it's toward the establishment, whether it's toward larger cities, larger institutions like the media or the government elites, and that was something that people were able to rally around.
And you said there's not necessarily agreement among Democrats right now, but what are the prevailing theories about why Democrats didn't turn up in as big a numbers as they did in previous elections?
There are a few theories out there. It would be bad to not mention the fact that Hillary Clinton did not campaign here during the general election. You'll get some disagreement over whether or not that would have made a difference. There are some folks who would have liked to have seen someone like the president or the first lady come here and hold one of the larger rallies like they held in past election years here that got people fired up. I mean, the thing about a rally is you can hold that rally and then say, okay, people, go vote. Democrats weren't doing a whole lot of those large, energizing sort of events. And then there's the question of voter ID and what kind of effect did that have, and what kind of effect did the confusion around just the constantly changing ongoing litigation over those election laws, and it's going to take some time to measure exactly what sort of impact that did have, but there's no question that that's part of the equation here.
I want to get to the voter ID in a moment, but to look a little closer at the rally. So Hillary Clinton herself did not visit Wisconsin once she had been named the official pick, the candidate for Democrats. Donald Trump did visit it, and it's also striking, you point out in your piece, some experts point out that there were these big rallies held in arenas for Donald Trump, but for Hillary Clinton, they seemed to be sort of more small venue things that didn't have quite that broad reach.
Yeah, you know, there are very clearly two different strategies. She sent, well, she didn't come here. She sent some surrogates. She sent Joe Biden, Tim Kaine, Chelsea Clinton was here, Bill Clinton was here a couple times. And a lot of those events, and we saw this sort of mirrored in the Senate race, too, with Russ Feingold on the trail, a lot of their events really seemed focused on trying to get supporters, volunteers, people working on the campaigns fired up to go out and do the work, as opposed to trying to appeal to voters directly and get them out to the polls. So it was smaller venues, it was lower key events, as opposed to these giant Trump rallies in arenas or outdoor venues. And then you saw in the last weekend before the election, Tim Kaine was here over the weekend, again, doing some smaller events, visiting breweries, offices, etc. And then you had prominent Republicans, Ron Johnson, Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, getting out and campaigning for the entire Republican ticket, doing large rallies, large events all throughout the state.
Jessie O'Poyen is with us now. She's a political reporter for the Capital Times, and she's with us right now to talk about why Wisconsin saw the lowest election turnout in two decades. And by the way, you can find a link to her piece on the Central Time Facebook page. And getting at some of the reasons behind this lower turnout in Wisconsin, as I understand it, Jessie, the U.S. Census report, taking a closer look at some of the demographics, will come out in a few months or so. What might that tell us?
Yeah, so what they do, I mean, they do this survey every month, but what they do after an election is ask voters or ask people whether they voted in the last election, and if they did not, why they didn't, and I think there's sort of a handful of answers they can give. So if it was, I didn't have the proper ID or I didn't know what I needed, something like that, that's something that we will find out in a much more quantifiable way when that report comes out, and that'll be a few months. We can also look at things like demographic groups. We can drill down more into turnout among, particular subsections of the voting population and see, are these the groups that are less likely to have the right ID, and then how are they turning out?
So it'll take a little while to get those numbers, but in the meantime, we have this lower turnout for Wisconsin. Is this expected to persist, for midterms and beyond, or is it this particular to this election?
I think that is a $1 million question. I don't think anybody knows. I think watching the primary, seeing that record turnout, there was a lot at stake for both parties in that election. It was a unique circumstance. Seeing early voting numbers go up again, it was sort of new that we had this expansion again that cities could expand the hours. A unique circumstance. Everything about this presidential election was a unique circumstance. So to see where it goes from here, I think, is going to be entirely unpredictable.
And looking at the voter ID law, as we start to wrap up, Jessie, the Group One Wisconsin Now has challenged the state's voter ID law. What is their take on what happened in Wisconsin?
So they were the plaintiff on this really broad challenge that a ruling came out earlier this summer. That was what led to overturning those early voting restrictions in terms of location and hours, and led to a couple other changes to election laws that were passed by Republicans over the last 5 years. But the thing that they were not able to overturn in that lawsuit was the voter ID law itself. And they do argue that that the voter ID law had a significant impact on turnout, and also argue that we may never be able to actually quantify what that impact was.
And Republicans have said this was in effect during the primary, and there was pretty decent turnout there, so it sounds like there's no consensus on this exactly yet.
That's for sure.
All right, Jesse, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
That was Jesse Apoyan. She's a political reporter for the Capital Times, and she joined us there to talk about why Wisconsin saw the lowest election turnout in two decades. And you can find a link to her piece over on the Central Time Facebook page. And let us know what you did. Did you turn out to vote this year? Did you stay at home because you weren't that into either candidate, that enthusiasm gap that Jesse was talking about, or did you get out and vote? Let us know what you think. You can share your stories and why you think Wisconsin had this lower voter turnout this year when it has been something of a high voting state in the past. This is Central Time.
Today's full moon isn't just an ordinary moon, it's a chance for a full-on super moon sighting.
This will be the closest full moon to the Earth this year, only 221,524 miles or so away from us. About 17,000 miles closer than average, though, and that makes it the closest full moon since 1948, according to NASA.
If it's a clear night, you might get some extra up-close details of the moon. It should look like it's about 14% bigger and 30% brighter in the sky. Now, last night, I think, is technically the supermoon. Tonight's supposed to be about the same. You went out for a look last night.
I incidentally saw it while I was out, but okay. I did notice
Not for the sole purpose of seeing
No, I just happened to be out for a walk with a friend, and I saw it, and I thought, oh, that's a remarkable moon. And then I thought, ding, 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 that must be the super moon. It was big and low in the sky and pink, and I tried to take a picture with it, but my camera was dead on my phone. But it was pretty remarkable.
I got a decent look at it, not when it was low in the sky, though, so it didn't look as mind-blowingly awesome as it could be. But you've got another shot tonight, still a really big, full super moon. Check it out. If you get a good picture, that's hard to do, take a good picture of the moon. I'll post it on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time.